Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week our guest is the director of the Center for Political Future and Practical Politics at the University of Southern California, political mastermind Bob Shrum. Now remember, we love taking your questions, so write into politicswarroom at gmail.com or send a tweet to @politicon for next week's show. We'll get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. Please check out the link to our sponsors, the Great Washington Post, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting the Post and these sponsors. It really helps make this podcast happen. Please tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, James, I want to encourage everyone out there to read Tom Friedman's New York Times column this week on the existential danger that Israel faces. An unresolved Gaza, rising unrest on the West Bank, Hezbollah threatening war from Lebanon, all due to the selfish and stupid policies of the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. His priority is only staying in office and not having to face a criminal trial when he leaves. He's sacrificing the country's long-term security, alienating much of the world from the Jewish state, creating strains with its main ally, the United States, and undermining Joe Biden, who last October, after the Hamas terrorist attack, went to Israel to eloquently come to their defense. Netanyahu, at the invitation of House Speaker Mike Johnson, is going to address a joint session of Congress on July 24. I think the Democrats made a big mistake in consenting to this. Bibi is playing on Biden, playing him for, a fool, I'm afraid, when it comes to the Middle East, and waiting for Trump. Loyalty is a four-letter word to him, and I think this July 24th appearance is going to be a circus.
Well, unfortunately, I spoke to Jim Gerstein a half hour ago, and of course, whatever Friedman said is correct. It's a really depressing in Israel. People are still angry. A lot of protests. It's very vibrant over there, but much more vibrant than I think most Americans understand. But it was the greatest intelligence failure and that greatest act of negligence since I don't know, World War II or something. I watched the Pearl Harbor. They kind of caught us napping. There's a lot of excuses. There's no excuse for October 7th. None. And he's going to come. And, he's got a little bit of a boost back home. He figures this will give him a bigger one. He can look like he's standing up to the American president. It's just a terribly depressing situation.
Yeah, and James, as you know, the Tom Friedman column really echoed what former Prime Minister Ehud Barak had written over the weekend. So this is hardly Americans from afar criticizing Israel. No. Tom Friedman has been a sensible, smart, thoughtful, and great supporter of Israel, as I think you are and I am.
As that Ehud's former client of mine, his former guest on his show.
Yeah.
I mean, he's you know, most decorated soldier, maybe the history of the IDF, you know. But it's everybody knows what happened. And we're just letting him, you know, like I've been stuff, and a lot of people, some of but a potential donor, and he said, well, like, I can't be for Biden because of the protests. Let me just straight. You blaming Biden because kids out there yelling genocide, Joe? I mean, I think a lot of these guys just want the tax cut. I'm sorry. It's a convenient excuse.
Right.
Well, I don't really want to be for Trump. But, you know, look at the Columbia protests. I can't be for Biden. It makes zero sense.
Well, and what gets me, James, even more, some of these guys, you know, the guy up at Harvard and the guy at Penn said, this is, you know, we cannot tolerate bigotry, right? Can't tolerate bigotry. We're going to support Trump. Oh, really?
You know, get their tax cuts. They'll support Trump's racism as long as they have the tax cuts, and they'll give it money. And they'll give a shit about Israel or any of that. It's all just a giant fucking head fake. The masses want their racism, and the elites want their tax cuts, and they're willing to dance with each other.
I do wish Biden would be tougher. I mean, I think he's trying to play the diplomatic card that he has known so well for so many years. And you can't play the diplomatic card with Bibi, because he's not on the level, to put it bluntly. He's a guy who's only interested in self-preservation. And I think the idea of kind of warning him and then going along a little bit more, warning him privately maybe, it just doesn't work. Sending Tony Blinken over there 7 times. I mean, I wish the president months ago would have said, I am, no one has supported Israel more than I have for 50 years. I love the country. I support its people. But I can no longer support the policies of this prime minister if he's not willing to at least talk with us. He wants our weapons. He wants our vote in international forums, but he doesn't want to listen to us. You know, it's tragic.
It is. It's very tragic.
It really is.
It's one of these things that, you know, Shimon Peres said, you got to understand the difference between a problem in a situation. And they don't have a problem. They have a situation that's going to be there forever. And, you know, they're just going to have to decide because, you know, to exchange their hostages for all those Palestinians they got in jail, and withdrawal is going to look like, it's not going to look good for Netanyahu, but it's all your fault. It's going to take Israel 50 years to dig out of Netanyahu's negligence.
Yeah. And he's going to stay in office probably for 2 more years, although, that's the great tragedy. And the reason he's staying in office is because he has conveniently put together, and I think shamefully put together, some of the craziest people in Israel. I mean, it kind of be like having Marjorie Taylor Greene and Josh Hawley and Matt Gaetz in your cabinet, the Israeli equivalent. And among other things, the top priority is to make sure that those deeply Orthodox Jews don't have to serve in the military. Let the others fight and die for you. It's outrageous. Anyway, James, let me turn to another subject. Juneteenth, which is celebrated this week, it's the end of slavery. I confess, I'm not very proud of this. I'm not proud of this at all. I didn't know until 4 or 5 years ago about Juneteenth, about the celebration of the end of slavery. And I think it's gratifying and really important that we recognize it as a holiday. Joe Biden deserves credit for that. Slavery was, you know, the great stain on the American experience. And while legal slavery ended in the Civil War, race remains today the great American dilemma. All you have to do is look at this presidential election. So I'm glad that government's closed, banks are closed. We ought to be celebrating Juneteenth, James.
Yeah, I agree, and you're right. I wasn't become more acutely aware of it, but I think it's important for this reason: is you can see the kind of lost cause people, of course, led by Trump, you know, as always. And they're trying to sneak this in. Well, maybe slavery wasn't so bad. Maybe Jim Crow. You see, these kind of black Republicans.
Yeah, blacks maybe were happy back then.
Yeah, and of course, there is massively not true. It's like arguing with somebody about, is the earth round? You try to muster arguments, and it's so obvious that the person originally thinking that. But I think it's important to keep in right out in front of the American consciousness the horror of slavery, the horror of Jim Crow, and the horror of racism. And I think this is a good idea because it goes through it. Because don't kid yourself, this kind of infectious stuff is out there, and it can carry more unless you take steps to contain it. I'd say eliminate it, but I don't think that's a realistic expectation. And I do think the Juneteenth does, you know, I think it's for descendants of slaves, it's very important. But for those of us who are not descendants of slaves, it's very important we're constantly reminded of how horrible this is.
Right.
How you could go back to something like this.
Absolutely. And it does remain the American dilemma, as Gunnar Myrdal wrote 80 years ago. But happy Juneteenth to everyone out there. Celebrate it. James, we lost a great black American this week, Willie Mays. Willie Mays was one of the great baseball players of all time. Jackie Robinson, of course, was the great courageous African-American who integrated baseball in the 40s. But then in the 50s, when you had, you know, those two of the greatest players ever, Mays and Aaron, they solidified it. And I guess I'll always remember as a kid, and I wasn't a Giants fan, but that incredible catch in the 1954 World Series. They were playing the Indians, two men on, Vic Worse up, and he hit a ball to the deepest part of the Polo Grounds, almost 480 feet. And Willie Mays ran, turned his back, and glove out. He caught the ball. Incredible play. Turned around, wheeled around, hat fell off, and tossed it in so the runners couldn't advance. I think it's almost every expert calls that the greatest catch in the history of baseball.
Well, there's one expert that disagrees with that, and that's none other than Willie Mays, who said, I made better catches. I was listening this morning on this is Mike Greenberg, one of the early morning shows, and Major League Baseball should really change their logo to a image of that catch of him running backwards and his number. And who cares if he made better ones? I mean, that's the one you remember. I've seen it a million times. I don't know how many times I've seen it. But, you know, one of the things, one of our great sponsors, the Washington Post, boy, if you want to read something really good, read George Will on Willie Mays. And I just say one thing about Willie Mays before we move on. He missed 2 years because of military service.
Right.
But we famously know what it cost Ted Williams. True enough. It cost DiMaggio something. But two peak Willie Mays years, shit, you're probably looking at another 80 home runs, another 200 RBIs, another 25 hits. It doesn't do any good to talk about it, but somehow or another, Willie Mays gets forgotten in the war years.
Well, he came up at 19 and 1951, and Leo DeRocher fell in love with him. He was absolutely great on that Giants team then. And then he did miss those 2 years. So just think, he was at his, you know, I mean, stayed at his peak for another 10 or 15 years, But that was a huge loss. And, you know, Willie Mays, I saw a bunch of games. He made great catches. And he may have thought other catches were better. I think it's hard to have a better catch than he had in the Polo Grounds.
I'm certainly not going to argue Willie Mays' catches. But what he was and what he did and how good he was, it's just really stunning. And, you know, when you've seen, I saw him play myself, so I mean, we all have. He wasn't some distant object. He wasn't like Babe Ruth. So I have a question for you, just a ballroom question, okay?
Yep.
What was the better hitting combination, Willie Mays, Willie McCovey, Covey at the peak, or Hank Aaron and Eddie Matthews?
I think Aaron was a slightly better hitter than Mays. I think Mays was a better fielder than Aaron. I think they were both great at everything. I told you this story. I think one time I'm name dropping now. I had dinner with Sandy Koufax, I said, my wife told me I was drooling. And I said, Sandy, it's the bottom of the ninth. You're ahead 2-1. The bases are loaded, 2 outs. Who would you least like to face? And he said, easiest question I've ever been asked, Henry Aaron. He said, Henry Aaron put the fear of God on me every time he came up. And then he added, as a baseball pitcher, would I got Rico Carty out 1 year, 32 straight times. And I said, what? He said, Carty batted ahead of Mays. You always got the guy out who batted ahead of Willie Mays, or ahead of Henry Aaron.
Right. So one of the things that Will pointed out is column is Born Spahn, I think one more game than any left-hander in history. Mays was 0-12 in the majors, and he gave up a home run to Willie Mays. He said, if I struck him out, I'd never had to deal with him again for the rest of my life. And then it was that epic game that Warren Spahn and Juan Marshall each went except like 16 scoreless innings, and it never happened again. And, of course, who homered to end the game other than Willie Mays?
Yeah.
But Warren Spahn had a complicated relationship with Willie Mays, to say the least. But DeRosa, when he hit it, he famously said, I've never seen a fucking ball hit so fucking hard and get out of a fucking ballpark so fucking fast in my whole fucking life.
Well, you know,
I think Leo got 10 fucks.
When I said that Henry Aaron, I thought, was a slightly better hitter, boy, that is not disparaging Willie Mays. It's a great debate that you could have forever because they're two of the greatest.
But who is a better peak ball player, Eddie Matthews? Willie McCovey. The guy who I read came down on Aaron and Matthews, but, you know, it wasn't by a lot. That's why people love baseball. They love these kind of arguments, and they're fun to resurrect.
No, it really was. But anyway, Willie Mays, you were a great baseball player. He was a great citizen. He stayed active with the Giants right up until the last couple of years. So
I wonder where we're going to look back and say we'll be gone, but the Mookie Betts, Ohtani, 1-2 punch, ain't bad.
Well, and Freddie Freeman hitting third. I mean, man.
Yeah, that's not too bad. You know,
the best 1-2-3 punch.
We always think the golden era, and we sometimes forget we might be living in a golden era for all we know.
Oh, that's the... I went to a baseball game with my dad, and I talked. It was actually Willie Mays, and I talked about how great Willie Mays was. And he said, yeah, but he said he's nothing like the old, nothing like Babe Ruth. And my kid one time was talking about how great a certain player was, and I said to him, no, it's not like Ruth and Aaron.
John Max the other day, but you know, talk about Mike Spade. He said, yeah, but he wasn't no Puddinhead Jones.
Most people don't know Willie Puddinhead Jones. I'll tell you. All right, great. Willie Mays, rest in peace. You were just a great athlete and a great American. You're missed.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
'Twas a night with ADT, home safe and secure. No worry, no stress. Your peace was assured. But outside arose such a clatter and sound. Good thing your cameras were keeping watch all around. Inside, all was calm. Not a worry drew near. Each loved one protected, enjoying good cheer. So this holiday season, let safety be key. When every second counts, count on ADT. Visit ADT.com and keep home worry-free.
Hey, James, the much-anticipated Biden-Trump debate a week away. We have the perfect guest to discuss this. That's what to look for. That's Robert Schrum, professor of practical politics at the University of Southern California. Once he was the national collegiate debate champion, and he has counseled many Democratic top politicians on debates, Ted Kennedy, Al Gore, John Kerry, just to name a few. But first of all, it's great that you could be with us.
It's great to see both of you.
I want to start with the generic, if you will. What do you look for in a political debate? I mean, my sense is it's not like a boxing match or diving contest where you score each round. You're the maestro in this. What do you look for in a debate?
Well, the first thing, and this is very important, you just made the argument, it's not scored like a regular debate. Richard Nixon won the coin flip for the first debate in 1960, and he stupidly chose to go second, thinking he'd be like a high school debater refuting Kennedy point by point. That let Kennedy have the opening statement, and he set the tone of the whole debate. The debate was supposed to be about domestic policy. He wanted to pass the commander-in-chief test, so he kept talking about foreign policy in the domestic policy debate, and he came out of it, and he passed the threshold. That takes me to this debate, because it's a great opportunity for Biden if he can pull it off. You know, the Republicans and MAGA world have been doing everything they can to make him look old, enfeebled, incoherent. They're lowering his expectations. And if he can go into that debate, be coherent, have a narrative line through what he's saying, then I think he can do what would be an analog to what Kennedy did, which is he can pass the threshold. And age will not be the same kind of issue. And the idea that he's somehow or other cognitively impaired can be put to rest.
Bob, that's such a good point. Are there two or three particular points that he wants to make sure to stress? And there's a couple things to avoid.
Well, the biggest thing I think he needs to do is to come across as someone who knows what he's talking about, can express himself clearly, and can, by contrast with Trump, who's been increasingly incoherent on the stump, he could come out looking strong. That's what he wants to do. And you said, what do people avoid? First thing I tell people is don't wear a watch. And James will understand that reference very well.
Right.
Because the temptation to look at your watch is almost overwhelming. And if you do it, you send a message to people, they almost wish you weren't there, which is what happened with George W. Bush when he was debating Bill Clinton.
George H.W. Bob, look at it from the perspective of Donald Trump, as hard as that may be. Do you just expect his usual slash and burn attack and a lie?
Unless they're not telling the truth, which frequently occurs, he's not doing any real debate prep. That's crazy. The last person I know of who didn't do any real debate prep was Jimmy Carter in 1980 when he was going to debate Ronald Reagan. It's a big mistake. I think Biden will do a very disciplined debate prep. What I expect from Trump is election denialism, a series of false statements like we had the lowest unemployment of any president in history, lowest black unemployment of any president in history, none of which is true. And it'll just be, you know, he'll talk, unless he's prepared and he listens, he's going to talk about sharks, electric batteries blowing up, all these fantasies that he engages in, windmills killing birds. And if you watch him recently, and this is why he should be doing debate prep, there is no narrative line through what he says. I mean, he just hops from one thing to another. Biden's biggest challenge, by the way, beyond what I talked about earlier, is his childhood stutter has reasserted itself. And he has a series of ways to deal with that. He'll say, ladies and gentlemen, or I really mean that, or he'll repeat the point. And so you're going to see some of that. I think that's absolutely inevitable.
Right. Let me try one more and then turn it over to James. And I guess in 2016, polls showed that Trump lost all three debates resoundingly to Hillary Clinton. Last time, polls showed after the Biden-Trump both debates, particularly the second one, that Biden won by 16, 17 points, yet the elections turned out quite differently. And I know you mentioned JFK, and I think you can also cite Reagan in 80. But in more recent times, do we exaggerate the significance of debates?
To some extent. John Kerry, according to the polls, won all three debates, lost the election.
Right.
It was close, but he lost the election. So I think there is a tendency to exaggerate, but the stakes are very high here. Biden took a risk and proposed this debate, proposed to do it early. And the reason he did it was, I believe, he wants to go in there and show that he's up to the job. The other thing to look for, by the way, is what kind of prepared lines people come with. Finally, by the way, I would worry, I would dissent a little bit about 2016. I think if you watch the whole first debate, you certainly thought Hillary Clinton won. But the first half hour of that debate, and that's the part that people really focus on. The first half hour of that debate, Donald Trump was trade, and going after Hillary Clinton on NAFTA, on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And I think that helped him in states like Wisconsin and Michigan. This is going to be very different, by the way. He's not going to be able to interrupt, or at least if they enforce the rules, he's not going to be able
to interrupt. James.
So, Bob, first of all, I don't know how far we'll go back, but a little social thing I want to clean up here. On September 1st, which is the Sunday before Labor Day, LSU and Southern Cal opened a season in Las Vegas. And you have a personal invitation for you and Otsi, and I happen to know because I've scouted it out. You can stay at the Four Seasons, and we can walk to the stadium. Because people like you and I, we don't want to be walking or going in traffic or anything like that.
Yeah.
And welcome to you and Otsi, invited to sit in the LSU AD's box with Mary and I. We would love to host y'all for this.
Oh, well, let me see if we can.
Just see if you can. Yeah.
I accept, assuming we can do it.
Yeah, and the bar at the Mandalay Bay is going to be full of Trojans and Tigers, and there will be a prodigious amount of drinking going on, I promise you. But just mark
it
down.
You won't do any.
No, not me. And for what I like about it, we can walk to the game, and we can stay at the Four Seasons. People our age, that's important. So you and I have been through debate prep. Shit, I don't know how many times, and Lloyd Doggett and Bob Casey and Ehud Barak and Zell Miller and Harris Wofford. And you're always, you know, looking for a kind of moment. What moment do you think, what's the question that Biden really wants in this debate?
What does he really wants to talk want? About he wants to talk about democracy, election denialism. He wants to talk about reproductive rights. He wants a chance to make the case on the economy and inflation without bragging. He can't say everything's great. He can say we've made progress. We have a lot more to do. And then the moments that he will be preparing for are the moments when Trump acts up and he can deliver a one-liner that's going to make a very big difference. I mean, in the first debate with John Kerry and George W. Bush, we knew that at some point Bush was going to justify the war in Iraq by citing 9/11. So Kerry went into the debate with a mantra in his head. He says, Saddam, you say Osama. And sure enough, Bush did it. We were attacked, Jim Lehrer said. We had to respond. And Kerry came back and said, wait a minute, Mr. President. We weren't attacked by Saddam Hussein. We were attacked by Osama bin Laden. And then Bush made it worse by saying, I know who attacked us. And the polls afterwards showed that Kerry had clearly won the debate. And as you know, it put him back in the race. He'd been after the Republican convention behind, and suddenly he was 3 or 4 points ahead at that point. So they're going to prepare for moments like that. And those moments, a moment can define a whole debate. Right. When Ted Kennedy was debating Romney in 1994, we knew because Romney had put an ad on the air saying it, that he was going to charge that the Kennedy family had made a lot of money by putting a furniture mart in Southwest Washington, which means he didn't know a lot about the way Washington looked at that time. Now, we found, and Kennedy didn't know anything about it. It turned out it was a family trust. It turned out that the city had come to the family and said, "Will you put a furniture mart there? Because we're trying to redevelop Southwest." But instead of talking about all of that, when Romney did it in the debate, Kennedy said, Ted Kennedy said, "The Kennedys did not go into politics to make money, Mr. Romney. And quite frankly, we have paid a price." And it blew the roof off Faneuil Hall. The debate was basically over.
I was sitting behind George Romney, as a matter of fact. And you could see he put his head in his hands after that line.
Yeah. So a line like that can really make a difference.
So, you know, talking about Kerry and the 9/11 and Saddam Hussein, the best line was, remember Richard Clark, who was the National Security Advisor? He said it would be like after Pearl Harbor, we invaded Mexico. we'll get them.
It's funny because these elections really do matter. I remember when we were preparing Gore's acceptance speech in 2000, and I had put a line in there based on a line he had used in 1992 in his vice presidential acceptance. And I have a message for Saddam Hussein. It is time for him to go. And Gore took a pen and drew a line right through it. Said, I'm not going to say something like that. I'm not going to do that. And I think if he had been president, and I still believe that he did win Florida, the Supreme Court stopped us from finding out definitively. If he had been president, I don't think we ever would have invaded Iraq. And we would have done something about climate change.
And we might have been prepared for 9/11.
Well, he scrupulously read his briefs.
I'm not going to ask you to say it, but I'm going to say this definitively. No person over the years has been closer to the Kennedy family than Bob Trump, period. Let's not argue that for a second. I want to ask you something. What is the of the family and you, how painful is this RFK Jr. thing?
Well, I think for anybody who cares about the legacy of JFK, RFK, Ted Kennedy, it's very painful. That's why the family, I believe, has been so outspoken about this. I think back to the fact that Ted Kennedy and Anthony Fauci worked so closely together to try to deal with AIDS. And Kennedy was the big advocate in the legislative branch for what became the greatest medical research project up to that point in history. And he worked with Anthony Fauci, and you got it. And Bobby Kennedy has written a book charging that Fauci and Bill Gates are in this vaccine conspiracy so they can make millions of dollars. That would be very painful for Ted Kennedy.
So, back to you. Well, you obviously have known RFK Jr. for a long period of time. Was he always this fucking crazy, or was this, did this come later in life?
I don't know him that well. I obviously have known him for 44 years, 45 right. years. I think he was always a little quirky and difficult, and, you know, he had his problems along the way. So this is a vanity project, and it has the potential to help elect Trump. I mean, Biden's going to have to do what Truman did in 1948. Nobody gave Truman a chance. He had a splinter party to the right of him with Strom Thurmond. He had a splinter party to the left of him with Henry Wallace, who'd been vice president before Truman with FDR. Nobody thought that the math could possibly add up for him. And Biden's going to have to try to pull the same thing off in 2024.
Okay, well, man, I just love talking. I've talked to you all day. Albert?
Well, I want to pick Bob. James did a actually terrific video on our Substack site last week on debates, and a couple points he made, which I think really, really are important. That for the you always ought to remember you're on camera. If the other guy's talking, you're on camera. I mean, I think, you know, I am as big a fan of Al Gore as you are. I think his so-called side didn't help him. It may not have been, you know, a killer, but it didn't help. But always remember you're on camera. And the other point James made is whatever the question, you know what you want your answer to be. And you have to be disciplined enough to know that.
Yes, I think that's right. And that's why you do debate camp, so that you test out a whole variety of questions. And what's the best answer? You can predict pretty much what the questions are going to be. And you can predict pretty much what the opponent's going to say. And you can get ready for that. That's why the discipline of going through a preparation process really matters. As for the camera always being on you, I have always begun every debate prep by saying, I don't care what the agreed upon rules say, you are always on camera. And the George W. Bush people very smartly after the first debate in 2000 went out and didn't talk about substance. They lost the debate on substance. You know, Bush was asked, you know, the unexpected happens. Can you tell me about something that you did in a crisis that tells us you're prepared for that? And he talked about going to a forest fire. Al Gore talked about the pivotal role he played in ending the war in the Balkans, enlisting a former president of Russia as an intermediary to end that conflict. But after Bush's answer, Gore then said, well, I went to a forest fire too. The other lesson I would draw out of that, by the way, is when you're winning a point, stop. Don't keep talking. You don't have to match what the other person says all the time.
You know, Bob, I was not a fan of the Presidential Debate Commission. The last time, I think the one that did work was the last one. A couple of things. They cut off the mics, which they say they're going to do this time when the other candidate was speaking. I think that cut down on Trump's bluster. And the moderator, Kristen Welker, did a really good job. I know Jake Tapper and Dana Bash. I think they're good journalists. I think moderators matter some, and I think I'm encouraged that they're going to be moderating this debate.
Listen, moderators can actually determine the outcome or come close to it of a debate. I'll give you two instances. In 1960, Sander Van Oker from NBC News, who was one of the questioners, asked a question of Richard Nixon. He said, you know, you go all around the country and you see signs saying experience counts. You're running on your experience and implying that Senator Kennedy doesn't have the kind of experience that's needed. But recently, when President Eisenhower was asked what you'd done that was significant in terms of contributing to a major decision, his answer was, I don't know. If you give me a week, I might think of something. Now, the truth is, there's no answer Nixon could have given that would work with that. The other one where a moderator really made a difference was in the second debate, I think it was the second debate, with Barack Obama and Mitt Romney, Romney was charging that Obama had not called the attack in Libya, in which our ambassador lost his wife, an act of terrorism, until 2 weeks after the event. And he turned toward Obama and said, Isn't that right? And Obama said, please proceed, Mr. Romney. And at that point, the moderator comes in, Candy Crowley, and she said, well, actually, he did call it an act of terrorism the very first day in the Rose Garden. That was the end of that issue. And Obama had not prepared for that first debate, as he should have. I mean, he had a debate camp, but he kept going out of it to do other things. And the result of that was that Libya just left the whole campaign, and Obama redeemed himself from a mediocre performance in the first debate.
Well, he did in the next debate, because he was terrible in that first debate. But I'll tell you who else helped redeem him was one Joseph R. Biden, who in the next debate debated Paul Ryan and again more than held his own. So there will be another presidential debate in September, I think, if it goes on. Bob, my impression, though, is that second debate is going to be less important than usual. And if Biden does what you want him to do and sets that proper predicate, then I think that'll be determinative for the rest of the campaign.
That's the big if. The big if is, can Biden pull this off? And that's the gamble they made when they put out this debate challenge. It reminds me of Gerald Ford in his acceptance speech when he was 30 points behind Jimmy Carter in 1976. At the beginning of that acceptance speech, challenging Carter to debate. And Ford almost won that election. And if he had not rhetorically freed Poland by saying there is no Soviet domination of Eastern Europe, and never will be under a Ford administration, I think he would have won the election.
That was in the debate, right? Right.
Yeah, yeah. I think it was in the second debate. First debate, Ford did very, very well. Second debate, he was doing well and then made this gaffe. And like all presidents who are surrounded most of the time, unless you have James in the room, by people who are going to say, oh, that was brilliant, that's right. He didn't want to let Jim Baker go out and clarify that. I mean, there were ways to get off it right away, but it took him several days to get off it. He just didn't want to admit he'd made a mistake.
James.
So I just make a general comment. One of the things that Bill Clinton told me and other people, I don't want that fucking guy in a meeting with me anymore. All he does is agree with me.
Ted Kennedy once said to me, why do I want to hire people who agree with me all the time? I can agree with myself.
Right.
smart politicians always have, and it's a JFK line that he said privately, that they want to have two or three people around who are allowed to tell them, indeed encouraged to tell them, when they're being dumb SOBs.
Right. And even when you give them bad advice, don't take it again because they're... You know, because people, there are certain people of which you've never been one. So here we are, we're in a debate. It's the money question. Bob Trump is here. Next question, Jake, is for President Biden. So Jake Tapper says, President Biden, polls consistently show that voters are very concerned about your age. How would you address this problem when voters look at you and says, you know, you're too old to be president? What's your answer?
Well,
to that?
Assuming he's doing well, I'd start off by saying, by doing what I'm doing tonight, by talking about the issues, by laying out a vision in ways that hopefully are persuasive and connect with people and give folks a sense of what I want to do in the next 4 years. That's why I talk about democracy all the time, because I think democracy is on the ballot. Anyway, something like that. Right. Basically, what he ought to say is, watch me.
Right. I still agree. And, you know, the other thing I would say is, okay, you're correct. I will be 82 in December. By the way, happy birthday to former President Trump. He was 78 recently. Okay? He's starting at 79. Yeah, I mean, anything, but don't fucking argue with the premise or say that the Times overcovers us. But when age comes wisdom, because that shit's not going to work. And your answer, you know, let's look at us right now. All right.
Yeah.
And see.
And you decide whether I'm up to the job.
Right. I totally agree. I can't tell you how much I enjoy. And tell Ootsie that one of the life-forming things that she told me is really trust Ina Garten. Ina Garten's recipes are just delicious. I can find, we were having dinner at that, when I did that thing at Southern Cal with you at the Cipriani restaurant. And it was one of the best times I've ever had in my life. And I do hope y'all can consider coming over to Las Vegas. I can make it as easy for you, an easy and peasy thing as you can.
I think we can do it. We have to go to a wedding later that week, but I think we'll be okay.
Hey, Bob, while you're at it, also tell Ootsie what a fabulous job her son did in that profile of Curtis Wilkie.
Oh, I will. It's in the Bitter Southerner. It's a great piece for people who don't know Curtis. About a legendary reporter at the Boston Globe.
And he's still a legend down in Oxford.
Yeah.
Carter worked for me in 92.
Really?
Yes. And by the way, a guy that I love, Bob, you know better than else. You love these old kind of white Southern liberals that just never cross the line. There's a new Greg Iles book, and it's really good. And it's very, very contemporary. And Greg's a very popular author from Natchez. He's a fellow traveler. And the book is, if people are reading it, I'm getting it. It's about a demagogue who like was a war hero and is a secretly gay racist. And it's all set in contemporary America. I want to get Greg on the show because he's a very popular author and everybody is raving about this book, and I really recommend it.
I'm going to go get it as soon as we're done. Both involved in, which was a candidate named Zell Miller, who was running for governor and who just before the debate suddenly told you that, you know, I don't know if I can do this. You called me and put me on the phone with him, and the two of us persuaded him, yeah, he'd go out on the stage and he'd do just fine, which is what happened.
You know, Bob, the person we met at the Lord Doggett, and we went through the Casey stuff, and we went through the Zell Miller stuff, and the Ehud stuff in Israel, and I mean, you've just been one of the oldest and dearest friends I've had, and literally one of the best political people I've ever been around in my entire life. And
well,
I love
your
wife to death.
You, of course, are a living legend.
Well, as long as I like the living part more than the legend part.
You like the living part a lot. I would just add to that I have had so many memorable moments with Robert Shrum, but one of the earlier ones was on a Jimmy Carter plane in 1976 during his very short stint as a Carter advisor. At that point, Bob, you and I both were nervous flyers. It was a terrible flight. It was all over the place. I think it was Philadelphia to Pittsburgh or the other way around.
Right.
We were basically, you know, on each other's lap. We were so scared. And then Carter
we were on the floor,
you up to the front. Yes.
We got down on the floor.
and then Carter called you up to the front first section to advise him. I wasn't surprised when you left that campaign a couple days later.
Well, that wasn't the reason I left, but, and Jimmy Carter is fortunate that he's lived such a long life and has been such a productive ex-president because it has helped enhance his reputation, which was not in great shape when he left the presidency.
No, he wasn't, but he has been, he's been largely redeemed, and that's good. You know, he's approaching either 99 or 100.
I think it's this fall, he would turn 100.
I thought after Rosalind passed away that he would leave soon, but he may outlive us all. Bob Shrum, you're as good a guest as anybody could ever hope for. Give Ootsie a hug and thank you.
Thank you, man.
Love you both. Take care.
See you in Las Vegas.
Yeah. Bye. Okay.
Bye.
Bye. I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
'Twas a night with ADT, home safe and secure. No worry, no stress. Your peace was assured. But outside arose such a clatter and sound. Good thing your cameras were keeping watch all around. Inside, all was calm. Not a worry drew near. Each loved one protected, enjoying good cheer. So this holiday season, let safety be key. When every second counts, count on ADT. Visit ADT.com and keep home worry-free.
Hey, now for the outrage of the week. You know, James, from time to time, we have tried to put together an all-star team of House Republican wackos, nutbags. You know, the Marjorie Taylor Greens of Jewish laser beams, Lauren Boebert of Beetlejuice, Paul Gosar, your own home state, Clay Higgins. You know, probably Florida's Matt Gaetz is more sleazy than crazy. The House Ethics Committee just put out a statement that they're investigating him for sex with, it looks like, a minor for an other incredible. They've never put out a statement like that before. So I think Matt Gaetz is probably a short-termer. But, you know, it was an all-star basketball team that we started with, maybe five, maybe 10. Now it's a football team. There's so many crazies, offense and defense, plus a lot of reserves. If Matt Gaetz is out, I have a new Florida member, though, Congresswoman Anna Luna. Now, never mind. Now, let's forget that she changed her name and, according to press reports, misrepresented her background. Says she's a messianic Jewish Christian. That, I guess, is covering all of your bases. But it's her nutty views that gets her on this team. The latest, she wants to send the House Sergeant-at-Arms to arrest Attorney General Merrick Garland. Why? Garland fully cooperated with the House turning over this transcript of special counsel's interviews with Joe Biden on the classified documents, but Republicans are insisting on the audio tapes. Now, why? They want to use them in political attack commercials this fall. Garland, as he should, said no. So Congresswoman Luna wants to have the House Sergeant-at-Arms arrest him. She's going to a highly qualified member for the all-nutbag team, James.
Yeah, she is. And I think we've got a good shot at that seat. As you know, I think we're going to do better in Florida than people anticipate. Am I saying that we're going to win the Senate? Biden's going to carry it. It's not what I'm suggesting right now. But I am suggesting that I think we're going to pick up a few seats. I think the massive issues in that state, flooding is just unfreaking believable. I don't think it would get worse. So for my outrage is a guy who really has had a bad week is Danny Snyder. Of course, it's now come out that he funded a movie about Trump. And it showed at the film festival in Cannes. Everybody was talking about having an Academy Award for the guy who played Trump. It was all about all the women that he raped. Understand, you would never know that because of Democratic messaging. There are 26 women that have credibly accused Donald J. Trump of sexual improprieties. And Dan Snyder, of course, he had the Washington Redskins. The shitty on-the-field product, the off-the-field product was even shittier. And all kind of sexual propriety stuff, every kind of thing you can imagine. But the reason that Danny Snyder has had a bad week, because, frankly, Paul Pressler is dead. And as long as Paul Pressler was alive, Danny Snyder could not be the worst human being in America. I'm going to read the lead on Paul Pressler's death from the Texas Tribune. Paul Pressler, comma, the monumental Southern Baptist leader and Republican active at the center of a massive sex abuse scandal, died on June 7th. He was 94. Well, he's now in hell with Jerry Falwell and Ken Starr. And I don't, at my age, never take pleasure in anybody else's death, but this was one rotten-ass human being. I might add, was a big pal of Speaker Mike Johnson's, who was going to be the dean of the law school at the Paul Pressler School of Law. Excuse me while I throw up. All right? And you know, I also point out always that the longest-serving Republican Speaker of the House is one Dennis Hastert, who was sentenced to the penitentiary, who the judge says he was a serial child molester. So the party of child molesters is front and center, and Paul Pressler's gone, and Danny Snyder could be elevated to the most loathsome human being in the United States.
Well, it's a contest, though, James. There was I'm forgetting his name. There was another evangelical pastor who advised Trump, who this week had to resign because it was revealed
he had
an affair with a 12-year-old girl.
Yeah,
a 12-year-old girl. So I mean, Danny Snyder's a contestant, no question. There's competition.
Paul Pressler, I think, had to settle with six boys. And yeah, they kept supplying. But he was very anti-gay. I have to say that about him. He was a real man of God. He ruined people's lives. They took over these seminaries and started teaching all this lunacy and idiocy. And you know, like I said, he's kind of taught never speak ill of the dead. Or, you know, you should find some intrinsic goodness in everybody. His life has to be used as an example. You know, you use George Washington's life as an example. You use, you know, Rosa Parks' life as an example. But you also got to use bad people's lives as an example. And Paul Pressler, to me, is the embodiment of right-wing moralism, hypocrisy, and criminality. And I think
you've really nailed it. Let's check and we'll report back next week. What, if anything, did Speaker Mike Johnson say about Mr. Pressler's death? We'll see.
There's tape of them at a fundraiser in Shreveport, and you can pull it up, and so you can throw up if you're having some indigestion. You want to force yourself to gag? Go look at that. These are really, I can't tell you that Mike Johnson is a bad human being. I don't know that. I'm sure he doesn't think he is. But boy, let me tell you, when you're a friend of Paul Pressler, you're really tolerant of rotten ass people.
Yeah, boy, that's for sure. Okay.
I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
'Twas a night with ADT, home safe and secure. No worry, no stress. Your peace was assured. But outside arose such a clatter and sound, Good thing your cameras were keeping watch all around. Inside, all was calm. Not a worry drew near. Each loved one protected, enjoying good cheer. So this holiday season, let safety be key. When every second counts, count on ADT. Visit ADT.com and keep home worry-free.
And now for one of our favorite segments, the listener questions. They are so good, and the hardest job I ever have is choosing from among the great ones, because they're all great. Brendan in Greenwich Village, New York, starts off, James, by saying President Biden has been strangely assured of victory while his polling has been mediocre. Is the White House ready to scorch the earth with heretofore unknown stories and intelligence regarding Trump's first term? I mean, what is it that's going to turn this around?
Man, if you'd ask me a question, I think about not every waking moment, but also sleeping moments. And I mean, the truth of the matter is, this race is just unchanged. If you squint hard, you might be able to find a point and a half deterioration in Trump's approval, but you really got to squint really hard. And again, they have to pick on a negative, and they have to have the discipline to stick with it, and the Democratic surrogates and spokespeople have to have the discipline to stick with that. It's the fundamental truth is we're trying to convince the country to do something the country doesn't want to do, and that's reelect the president. Now, the good news, they don't want to bring Trump back either, but it's so far public opinion in the United States pretty well locked in, and we got to come up with a strategy to make a big effort to try to move it.
Boy. Kyle in Portland, Oregon says, how are Democrats not more trusted on the economy after what's happened over the last 30 years? Economic issues feel like they should be a layup. They should, Kyle. A couple things. This is really compared to almost any other major country in the world. We are the envy of the world when it comes to our economic performance post-COVID. Inflation is a problem, and that affects more people, and that's part of the problem. The other part of the problem is that, frankly, this White House and this president don't articulate their economic message very well. I have a feeling that under an Obama or a Clinton that the numbers would be better. And but let's face it, some of these rich guys, the Jamie Dimons, the Steve Schwartzmans, they're not looking at the economy. They're not looking at how Democrats or Republicans are doing. They're looking at, you know, their tax cuts and how much wealthier they can get. So I think you're right, Kyle. I think the public on this one is wrong.
Well, there are a couple of things. First, Professor Alan Blonder, Princeton, who's one of the nicest guys I've ever known and also one of the smartest, has done research on this. It's the disparity in economic performance among Democrats and Republicans is breathtaking. It's actually, I think, a book called It's Not Even Close. I have people tell me all the time, well, you know, I like the Republicans' economic, but, you know, I more like Democrats on socialism. What is it? Why would a person who votes the economy ever vote for a Republican? I don't know.
Unless they're rich and they get tax cuts.
That's it. But you're not voting on the economy. You're voting on your bank account. You're not voting on the economy. By the way, all companies make more money under... Everyone makes more money. The amount of money that J.P. Morgan has made under Democratic administrations, it doesn't even matter. All right? Jamie Dimon could pay 15% more federal income tax. He's made so much fucking money, it's unbelievable. Same is true with Steve Schwartzman. I've rarely done under Obama. But I can't do it. But there is earthly no reason in the world, none, zero, that a voter who votes their economic interests could possibly vote for a Republican. Maybe if you're a tobacco farmer, manufacturer, you know. Or a gun, I guess if you're a gun manufacturer.
A gun manufacturer, yeah.
I don't even think they do better under Republicans.
This next question is goes to, it really, it bothers me. It's right. Jim in Iowa City, Iowa, says, I am an Iowan born and bred. I'm old enough to remember Harold Hughes, Tom Harkin, Tom Vilsack. I would add John Culver and Dick Clark. We were a moderate state, committed to good governance. The latest Seltzer poll has Biden at 32%. Is this the president's fault, Iowa's fault, both?
So your answer is just both?
Well, it could be that, yeah. I mean, Jim wants to know.
This is my question.
Yep.
Why Iowa behave so differently than Wisconsin? They're certainly in the same part of the world, to say the least. The demographic makeups are maybe in Wisconsin a little bit more diverse, but not by a lot. And we've had real success in Wisconsin, and we've had colossal failure in Iowa. And I would love for an analyst, a good journalist, to say, what's the difference here? And, you know, then those guys, you can factor in that there's a slightly bigger African-American black vote in Wisconsin. Maybe there's a bit, it's not much different. But, no. Man, if they produce different results, you know, Iowa used to be a safe, almost a near safe. You'd think of it like you'd think of Minnesota almost. But something has happened. And it has a very high percent of non-college whites. But I don't know if it's...
And older folks.
It's older. You could control... Why Wisconsin does so much better for Democrats in Iowa? I don't know.
Let's ask Ann Seltzer, who does this poll and is one of the great pollsters of all times. So I'm gonna ask her, and we'll get back to that next week.
Right, 32% in Iowa is just awful. There's no other way. Lyndon Johnson, some aide was saying, "Well, we could say this about this." He said, "Son, you can't shine shit."
Yeah.
And this was
James.
Bob
in California. Bob, we're going to read this question, but you've got to tell us where you're from in California next time, because California is a big state. So it's not enough to say Bob in California. Though we'll make an exception this time. He wants to know, why doesn't the Democratic Party drive home to the voting public that this turmoil, economic turmoil, is caused by the top 1% doing everything they can to bankrupt the country in hopes they can put off paying more taxes in the future? Well, Bob, you're on to something. We talked about it earlier. And I think that Joe Biden should be picking up some of the message that Bobby Casey in Pennsylvania and others have. You know, there's a ripoff going on. I mean, some of inflation is structural, but there's also some of it is caused by greedy corporations. And I don't think it means you're anti-business if you're anti-greed. And Bob, I think you're right. I don't think Democrats, with exceptions like Casey, are doing a very good job on that.
I so think he's right. The sad thing is, if you listen to people, I do focus groups, then they talk about inflation and say, well, Biden can't cause it. He's too old to cause inflation. Okay, just telling you what time it is. Not telling you anything else. And they all think that it's a price-fixing, backdoor antitrust bullshit, and they're right. And, you know, what Biden talks about, because he'll have to talk about it, assuming Trump shows up, he can talk about things that he has done to try to help. Prescription drugs, student loans, strategic reserve, but more importantly, he can say what we're going to really be aggressive on is this illegal price fixing that's going on. You saw Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago allowing the energy companies to do whatever they wanted for $1 billion campaign contribution. Do you think these energy companies going to, you know, how much, what did it go to bottom line of the big energy companies, an extra 15 cents a gallon of gas? It's to billions, to hundreds of billions. And that's where the culprit lies. And of course, the Wall Street Journal, the 12th grade, you're going to say, oh, it's anti-business, it's blaming business, it's the same playbook. Well, people believe, and I think they're probably right, that that these all companies, airlines, insurance companies, big food companies, the whole thing, they're all in ongoing conversations with each other, to say the least.
Yeah, I agree. James, this is Dr. Jeff in New Albany, Ohio. I've been to New Albany. He wants to know if the Supreme Court is merely protecting Trump, or are they more concerned about protecting their spouses, themselves, the complicit members of Congress, and others in the executive branch? Or, Dr. Jeff gives you maybe the answer, James, all of the above.
Well, it's, of course, all of the above is generally always the better answer. But, well, first of all, they're corrupt. Let's just start. When you start from a position of corruption, then that, and of course, they're financially corrupt. We know that. They go on trips. They get $4 million. I mean, more of this is coming. They're also intellectually corrupt because they just pick a result that the people that give them money want, and they just go to that result. And it's staggering deterioration of an entire branch of government. I'm sorry. It's going on, right? And I hope that the president is very forceful and very upfront about this entire issue, because they're not popular. No one likes them anymore. And exploit them for political benefit. They don't have honest differences. They don't get along with each other. They're not good people of you know, different backgrounds who have coalesced around the law. They don't give a fuck about the law. You think Clarence Thomas and Sam Alito give a rat's ass about any of this? Of course not. It's all about pleasing their financial masters. It's just sickening what's happened to the Supreme Court.
It is, and if anyone has any doubt that this is a Republican Supreme Court, just look at this Trump immunity case. They've held it for months. They could have decided it back in December. They are protecting Trump and the Republican Party. James Wesley in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania says, when I am going to be bombarded by commercials featuring a woman, I guess he's saying he has been, driving across a red state line and being stopped by the police, the woman asks why, and the officer tells her it's because she's pregnant and is being monitored. That reminds me of, I guess he says Lyndon Johnson's nuclear ad, the little girl picking the flower, which actually never ran. Thoughts? Very legitimate ad. I mean, it's true. I mean, when it's absolutely true, it's very legitimate. It happens in Texas. I think the one, we're looking for good news. I'll give you one bit of slightly good news. I think we've learned since Dobbs that not only is abortion a winning issue for Democrats, it usually, when the issue is front and center, it does the election does better than the polling, just by a little bit. I mean, New York 3 was an example where they thought they were going to win by 3 or 4. They won by 7 or 8. Why? Because abortion turned out more voters. I think you're going to see that. I'm not sure about the presidential election, but you're certainly going to see that in some Senate and House races this year.
Well, first of all, the obvious, we haven't lost an election since Dobbs. Anywhere. I mean, what, it was some, I don't know, congressional election. Ohio was supposed to lose by 30. We lost by 10.
Nine,
or whatever. Okay. The point is, but the whole court is a golden issue. And they're holding all of this stuff. And they're going to come down and put themselves front and center. And I think they're still skeptical about Trump showing up for the debate, but they definitely try to hold it till after the debate. I mean, it's so fucking nakedly political and corrupt. It's hard to imagine.
Yeah, it really is. James, the last question today comes from Brad in Los Angeles, California. I want it to be noted, Bob, in California, that Brad tells us where he's from in California. He says,
if you're from Los Angeles, you can get more specific, because
I'll give Brad a pass. I'd like it if he'd be more specific, but it's better than Bob on this one.
Right.
Brad says, okay. I frequently hear the argument from some on the right that concerns about democracy should be minimized because the United States is a constitutional republic and not a democracy. Could you please explain what they mean and the basis for this argument? I just think it's in bad faith.
Well, first of all, thank you. How do I say this delicately? So that they did this thing and they were interviewing these people, and he says, we're not a democracy, we're a republic. We're not a democracy, we're a republic. And so finally, the guy says, what is a republic? And of course, there I am. Let me name a republic for you. North Korea, okay? Iran is a republic, calls itself a republic. Remember the DGR, the German Democratic Republic?
Right.
And so about all it means, if to the extent that it other than just people referring to themselves, I mean, I don't think North Korea is approaching a democracy. Of course it's not. Or Iran. Or remember the USSR? What was the R in the USSR?
Right.
All right? So it's colossally stupid. It doesn't even account for anything. And these people are giant fools. And of course, if you studied this shit in the ninth grade, it's a representative democracy, not a participatory democracy. And they'll point to some town in New Hampshire where, the whole town votes on something. But people have no idea what the fuck they're talking about, and they just blather the stupidest shit that you can imagine, and that is the big talking point. Well, we're a republic. We're not a democracy. What the fuck is a republic? Anybody can call themselves a republic. I give the Brits credit. At least they don't try to pretend.
I can't add to that because it was so good, James. I think that our Los Angeles friend now has his answer when the right wing crazies.
Yeah, you say we're a republic. Let me name some fellow republics. It ain't democracies. Some of the worst people in the world call themselves republics.
Keep those questions coming in. If we didn't get to yours this week, we'll try to get to it next week. So thank you. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. Don't forget to send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd appreciate it if you check out the link to our sponsors, The Washington Post, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them, because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. You can also find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. And remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.